From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program are Mohammed El-Shenawy, VOA Senior Middle East Reporter, and Mitch Biter. He's Assistant Producer in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. Our topic on this edition of the program, has the Arab Spring finally arrived in Algeria and Sudan, where mass protests threaten to topple longstanding autocratic regimes? Our guest, Michelle Dunn, Director and Senior Fellow in the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and that's a foreign policy think tank here in Washington. Previously, Michelle worked at the Atlantic Council, where she was the founding director of the Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. She has also served as a Middle East advisor at the U.S. Department of State. We'll talk with Michelle Dunn about the significance of popular protests rocking both Algeria and Sudan, and to what extent they signal political changes in these two Arab nations, which eluded the 2011 wave of democratic uprisings. In Algeria, the sixth largest exporter of natural gas in the world, President Abdelaziz Bouteflika resigned this week under pressure from the army following weeks of massive demonstrations, ending the reign of North Africa's longest-serving leader. Mass protests broke out in late February, calling for Bouteflika, who has ruled for 20 years, to desist from seeking a fifth term. When Bouteflika hedged, saying he would call new elections if he won the election, originally scheduled for April 18, now indefinitely postponed, the protests only grew larger. The cumulative effect of the protests, coupled with a statement from the Army Chief of Staff, the traditional arbiter of political life in Algeria, saying Bouteflika was, quote, unfit for office, precipitated his abrupt resignation. In Sudan, after facing more than 3 months of street protests calling for his resignation, President Omar al-Bashir has decided to consolidate power. Instead of enacting economic and political reforms, Bashir, who has ruled for 30 years, has doubled down on brute force and declared a one-year state of emergency. He has allowed his security forces, who have killed dozens of protesters and imprisoned many others, to act with impunity. In response, protests, which initially began in December over rising food prices, have only grown. Many in Sudan hope that Bashir's draconian response will backfire and that his days are numbered. In Egypt, we have the Arab Spring in reverse. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been slowly suffocating free speech since he seized power in 2013, showing little regard for human rights as he looks to capitalize on his country's natural gas supply and Europe's need for his support on matters of terrorism and immigration. Moreover, the Egyptian parliament has supported changes to their constitution, which could extend el-Sisi's rule until 2034. We'll discuss it all with Michelle Dunn, who joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleagues, Mohammed El-Shenawy.
Thank you.
And Mitch Biter.
Thanks, Carol.
Well, Michelle, Algeria, talk about the significance of Bouteflika's abrupt resignation. He's been ailing from a stroke since 2013, rarely seen in public. He's been trying to hang on at all costs, but couldn't do it. How do you see this turn of events?
Bouteflika's resignation, his forced resignation by the Army Chief of Staff, is definitely a very important turning point in Algeria. The question is, we don't really know what direction the country will go at this point. But the fact that Algeria was pretty quiet during most of the Arab Spring uprisings in other countries, people saw it as having been traumatized by the long, bloody civil war of the 1990s. It was very significant to see the youth of the country and so forth finally gathering themselves. I mean, they were faced with an absurd situation, a president who had been effectively disabled for 5 years, being put up for election again. So they finally said this is enough. The problem is that it's not clear that the protesters know what they want and are unified around specific and achievable goals.
And of course, the so-called pouvoir is still in control, and Define what that means for our listeners, le pouvoir.
Well, what le pouvoir has meant in Algeria has been the military, the security forces, and business oligarchs who basically ran the country. Bouteflika himself was not just a puppet, though. He was a significant figure, a power within the power, so to speak. But what we're seeing right now is very interesting development. There is a bit of a rift within the pouvoir. We've seen the army chief of staff, Qaid Saleh, try to take the side of the protesters in a certain way, and certainly to break with Bouteflika, but also to break with the business oligarchs around Bouteflika. Ali Haddad, who was one of the most important, powerful business figures in the country, has been arrested. Other business figures have been banned from travel and so forth. This is a parallel with what happened in Egypt back in 2011, where the army broke with those around the Mubarak's at that time, the business figures, because I think the military wanted to disassociate itself from the corruption that the protesters were so against. However, it's a bit of a false distinction. They're trying to make that distinction that they're not part of the corruption. I'm not sure that's really true, but that's the impression they want to create.
Now a question from Mitch.
Hi, Michelle. Do you think Bouteflika's resignation, as you were talking about, will lead to real fundamental change, or is it another in a series of ploys intended to allow him and his system to remain in power?
Mitch, what I think is happening right now is that the Army Chief of Staff and others around him in the power structure are going to try to manage a process to bring about what looks like a transition with minimal change in the actual arrangements of power. That's probably what they will try to do. The question is, what will the protesters do? Will they accept that? Will they play along and trust some sort of a transition process, perhaps a constitutional process, perhaps new presidential elections with different candidates and so forth? Or will they push for more profound change? The protesters have been saying it's not just Bouteflika, it's the system that has to change. What we haven't seen really is a unified political leadership and some sort of clear and specific demands from the protesters about the sort of change they want.
Mohammed.
Without clear leadership of the Algerian uprising and not having enough trust in the political parties in the opposition, what model would Algeria adopt, the Tunisian model or the Egyptian one?
Well, yes, Mohammed, that's an interesting question because, of course, right next door is Tunisia, which does have an ongoing and viable democratic transition, although troubled by many problems, but still going forward. And then Egypt, of course, had a short-circuited democratic transition that ended in 2013 with a military coup. Unfortunately, many of the aspects of the Algerian political situation are perhaps a little bit more similar to Egypt than Tunisia. Not everything is identical, of course. But I think that the Algerians have the ability to look at these other examples in their neighborhood to learn lessons from them. Clearly, the Tunisians learned lessons from the Egyptian failure. Tunisia's own democratic transition was on the verge of failing in 2013, and then they saw what happened in Egypt and the major political forces compromised and moved forward. So perhaps the Algerians likewise. You mentioned that there isn't clear political leadership. That's true. But sometimes leadership emerges in situations like this where there's a real need for it.
Michelle, let's step back again. We talked about the proximate cause for all of these demonstrations, which was Bouteflika saying he's going to run for a fifth term. But what does the economy have to do with it? Talk about the economy and the repression of the media and civil society.
The economy has definitely been a factor in all of the Arab uprisings, including Algeria. Now, Algeria has been a hydrocarbon exporter, but what we are seeing is with the falling prices and so forth that Algeria's economy needs to transition away from this heavy dependence, away from being essentially a rentier state, as some of the states in the region are. The state has been less able to buy social peace because it hasn't had the kind of revenues that it had in the past. And we saw a real slowly building, economically based protest throughout the country. This has been a factor in some of the other countries as well. It happened in Egypt before 2011 as well. Sometimes we see this where there will be small, economically based protests all over the country going more and more, and then eventually they become more political and they become more pointed at the leadership. I think that did happen in Algeria. At the moment, everyone is focused on politics in Algeria. What will happen? Will the political sources of power and legitimacy and so forth, will all of this be changed or not? But eventually, they will need a new economic vision for the country going forward.
What is the U.S. position? Because Algeria is a very important partner, particularly in counterterrorism.
Right now, there have just been a couple of statements where they've been sort of, we recognize the demands of the protesters and hoping that things will remain peaceful, which in Algeria they have up to this point. We haven't seen a lot of comment out of the U.S. administration. It's been mildly supportive of the protests. Algeria is a major counterterrorism partner. I think the United States would become concerned if we were looking at a failed state scenario. Certainly what has happened in Libya gives people pause about the possibility of ungoverned spaces in North Africa where terrorist groups can create safe havens, where migrants from the rest of the African continent can traverse these spaces without controls and so forth. I don't think anyone would want to see Algeria going in that direction.
The protests were spread throughout the country, not just in Algiers.
Yes, that's correct.
Mohammed.
In Libya, we saw that the regional and the international players derailed the transition to democracy by intervention. Would we see a similar pattern of intervention from regional and international players weighing in Algeria?
Regional and international players have played a lot of different roles, and many of them unconstructive, in these various countries, in Libya and Egypt. Tunisia, in a way, has benefited, I think, by being considered a little bit of a backwater and by having less international intervention. I won't say no international intervention, but less. Libya, as you noted, had a NATO-led military intervention with the participation of some of the regional parties, but then no follow-up to that, no real peacemaking, stabilization efforts after that, which really left the country in chaos. Egypt saw no military intervention, thank goodness, but a very heavy economic intervention, especially by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates at the time of the military coup. So what will happen in Algeria? Algeria should not be in need of the kind of immediate economic assistance that the Gulf states stepped up and did in Egypt in 2013. It's not as poor a country. And I think Algerians would pretty energetically resist any kind of foreign military or economic intervention. They have a painful colonial history with France, a very strong national sense of not wanting foreign intervention, and actually a very anti-interventionist foreign policy of their own. For the most part, let's leave aside for a minute their relationship with Morocco and Western Sahara. But other than that, I mean, even, for example, with Tunisia and Libya, Algeria watched these things happening with Tunisia and Libya and didn't really intervene, sort of kept with its non-intervention foreign policy. So I think Algerians will be very allergic to any intervention in their country. They're very unlikely to call for it, as many Libyans, for example, did call for foreign military intervention.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Michelle Dunn. She's the director and senior fellow in the Middle East Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Mohammed El-Shanawi, VOA senior Middle East reporter, and Mitch Biter, assistant producer in VOA's Current Affairs Unit. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. And here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Mohamed Alamin Bashir from Khartoum, Sudan, which we'll speak about in just a moment. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And indeed, Michelle, moving on to Sudan, another autocratic Arab regime, but there's differences with Algeria. Some analysts are saying that the protests there are perhaps the closest to dislodging him as any before. How and why did these protests grow? And do you think they indeed threaten the rule of Omar al-Bashir?
The protests in Sudan have been going on longer, for example, than the protests in Algeria, but probably at not quite as high a level of participation. There are many grievances there. There are certainly economic grievances. There are grievances, just governance mismanagement type of grievances, and there are political grievances. Bashir has been in power in Sudan for a very long time. I mean, he's been effectively in control since 1989. He's been the elected president since 2010, and he himself was coming up against a situation in which, as of next year, 2020, he will have served the 2 5-year terms that are allowed under the current Sudanese constitution, and he should leave office. But he was making moves to have the constitution amended, as authoritarian incumbents often do, to allow him to run again. That has had to be put aside because of the level of protest in the country. So there are a lot of different grievances. Unfortunately, the Sudanese government has used a great deal of force against the protesters. We have, I think, more than 50 people killed so far. Unfortunately, as a lot of violence is used against protesters, the trajectory starts to look different than if protests are allowed to grow very large and remain nonviolent.
Mitch Beiter for a question.
Yeah, so why did Omar al-Bashir initially say he would promote dialogue and reform? I believe he had some sort of a listening tour, and then he backed down, especially with this recent emergency declaration.
Yes, so he did declare a state of emergency for 1 year. I believe the parliament dialed that back to 6 months, but of course these things can be renewed. Look, we have seen with Bashir, but also with Bouteflika and other Arab leaders who face these kind of protests, that they're all over the map, that they try a lot of different things to see if they can somehow get people out of the streets, get people to stop protesting. And Bashir has done that, too. They're still promising things, that there's going to be a national dialogue. He stepped down from being the head of the ruling party. I think he's feeling around to see what he can do to quiet things down. I think, though, that what has now happened in Algeria might mean that Sudanese protesters will be a bit encouraged to continue to press.
Michelle, the complexities of Sudanese politics suggest that a variety of scenarios may emerge in response to the ongoing protests. Can you give us some examples of such different scenarios in Sudan?
Well, there's a wide range of possibilities, and it's important that we remember, even though, for example, these uprisings in Algeria and Sudan are going on at the same time, and the protesters have some common grievances, including a longtime incumbent president they'd like to get rid of, that doesn't mean they'll go in the same direction. As we saw with the Arab uprisings of 2011, they took really starkly different trajectories. So that could be the case here, too. One of the things that strikes me as a possibility would be Bashir now has stepped down from being the head of the ruling party. The deputy head has stepped up. The party was supposed to have a regularly scheduled party congress, and then the head of the party would normally be put forward in the presidential election. There's a small possibility that someone else could be put forward in the presidential election, but Bashir could continue to be a power behind the throne, almost a sort of Putin scenario, as we've seen. I'm just sort of imagining things here. The other thing that is a possibility that I hope will not happen is a real escalation of violence, of the Sudanese government continuing to escalate its violence against protesters, and then protesters starting to use violence back. I mean, that's the very scary scenario that we saw unfurl in Syria.
Talk about the protesters. How do they compare with those in Algeria? Is it a broad cross-section? I've read that they're very professional, they're disgruntled.
They're really so dedicated, doctors and people just looking for a better life.
Yes, in both of these countries. And really, it has to be that way, I think, for these protests to force any kind of response from the governments. The protests have to be massive. These countries are used to having small protests of dozens of people or hundreds of people or even a couple of thousand people, and it doesn't really move the needle. It's when the protests become very large, and therefore they have to be from a large cross-section of society. Normally, it is people from the middle class, educated people who kind of start these things, educated youth who have very poor employment prospects or prospects of gaining any political say in these societies. They're often the leaders. But then the more things go on, then you see the more and more people joining. And even a lot like in Algeria, a lot of people formerly closely associated with the regime will start to join as it becomes clear that, okay, these protests maybe are going to bring about some change. So let me jump on the bandwagon now before it's too late.
Before we turn to Egypt, Omar al-Bashir, of course, has an ICC, an International Criminal Court, arrest warrant on his head. But unlike Algeria, it seems to me he has some strong international allies, Michel, maybe the UAE, Egypt, those that he would distance himself. He was more associated with Muslim Brotherhood, and now he's embracing these more authoritarian regimes.
Yes, I think that some of the other regimes, although they haven't always liked Bashir, will see it in their interest that he remain in power. Egypt, for example, of course, Egypt and Sudan have a very close relationship, usually more or less dominated by Egypt, going way back. An interesting thing happened over the past couple of years where Sudan started to grow much closer to Ethiopia because its economic interests as being more closely associated with Ethiopia, as Ethiopia was building the Grand Renaissance Dam and so forth. And that was very alarming to Egypt. Egypt then tried to draw closer to Sudan, and Sisi in Egypt has been supporting Bashir very strongly against these protests. I mean, he would not want to see the president of Sudan removed by protests.
Well, that leads us to talk about Egypt. As we said, it seems like the opposite trend is happening in Egypt, the opposite of Algeria and Sudan with these protests. 8 years after Egypt's Arab Spring ushered in a brief period of democratic governance, we see al-Sisi has consolidated his power. It's one of the most repressive in Egypt's modern history. Now he's introduced constitutional changes that would lengthen presidential terms to 6 years and exempt him from a two-term limit, allowing him to serve until 2034. So with that, let me turn to Mohammed.
Well, the Egyptian president will meet President Trump on April 9, 2 weeks ahead of the referendum on the constitutional amendments. Does the United States have any leverage to improve Egypt's human rights record?
Mohammed, I don't think the United States can improve Egypt's human rights record, but what it can do is to make clear when the United States wants to disassociate itself or express disapproval or say that Egypt is on a worrisome trajectory, which is normally what the United States does in these cases. You know, this has happened all over the world where incumbents try to change constitutions to keep themselves in power or to rearrange powers. As you're well aware, Mohammed, with the constitutional amendments, it's going to give the military an actually constitutional ability to intervene in politics and take most of the independence of the judiciary away. So even beyond the term limits, there are other concerning things. Normally, the United States speaks up about these things. Even in the Trump administration, they have done so many times and simply said, we're concerned, these developments are worrying, we don't think this is the right direction for the stability of the country, let alone the growth of democracy. It's unfortunate that so far we haven't seen the U.S. government do that regarding Egypt. Rather, we're seeing President Trump invite President Sisi to Washington. It's not entirely clear what the reason for the trip is, and we will see what President Trump says. But up till now, we have not heard a word of concern from the U.S. government about these constitutional amendments.
But would the Congress put any linkage between the military aid to Egypt and human rights and the rule of law?
I expect that there will be criticism from significant, important members of the U.S. Congress of these constitutional amendments. There is conditionality written into the legislation regarding U.S. military assistance to Egypt. A portion, almost a quarter, of that military assistance is subject to conditions related to human rights and democracy. That's going to continue to be an issue, and I think we're going to continue to see a bit of a struggle between the Congress and the administration. The Congress wanting to uphold the traditional role of the United States in championing human rights and democracy around the world and wanting to make some cuts to assistance to Egypt, or at least withhold some assistance from Egypt in order to make a point, and the administration not wanting to do that, partly because I think the administration has in mind a role for Egypt in the planned Trump-Israel
deal
peace
of the
plan
century.
Or deal of the century. Yeah. That could be one reason why they would want to keep relations with Sisi friendly and without tension.
Now a question for Mitch.
Michelle, I just wanted to ask you a question more turning domestically towards Egypt. What are al-Sisi's short and long-term plans for the country, you think? He's proposed a bunch of infrastructure plans, such as a paint job of Cairo's slums and a new administrative capital. Do you think they're enough to overcome Egypt's worsening economy? Do they impact his ambitions for the region?
Yeah, because the Egyptian economy is a real paradox right now. If you listen to the International Monetary Fund, for example, they'll tell you the Egyptian government is doing great on the economy because they're implementing austerity measures that they have long needed to do, such as cutting energy subsidies. And they have a growth rate that doesn't look bad. It's something like 5.3, 5.4% economic growth. However, if you look a little deeper, I think the Egyptian economy is in deep trouble. First, there are problems that are not being addressed. They have very high population growth, and that eats up much of that economic growth. That number doesn't look as meaningful once we're looking at more than 2.5% population growth a year. The other thing is that growth is driven by government infrastructure projects and the energy sector. The energy sector is not a big job generator. Government infrastructure projects generate some jobs, like construction jobs and so forth. But we're not looking at robust foreign or domestic investment in Egypt. We're not looking at the development of real productive capacity, industrial, service sector, etc. Most of this is not really happening. And so Egypt continues to have a high unemployment rate, high youth unemployment rate, and partly because of the austerity measures, they also have high inflation. So a lot of Egyptians are really suffering. There was a very prominent Egyptian who gave a talk about the economy a couple of weeks ago in Cairo, who talked about the downward mobility of Egyptians, that we're seeing Egyptians falling from the upper class to the middle class, from the middle class to the lower class, because they just can't find the jobs, and meanwhile, prices keep going up and up.
And the most serious challenge now is the amount of debts that Sisi is introducing Egypt to. It is
a very high level of both domestic and foreign debt. And domestic debt is one of the things that makes it difficult for the private sector to take off in Egypt. Borrowing is very difficult and very expensive inside the country. The other issue that I have to raise is the role of the military in the economy. You know, Mitch asked me, what does Sisi want to do with the country? One of the things he wants to do with the country is continue to increase the role of the military in politics, in the economy. Sisi's a military man. He's known nothing else since his teens. He believes the military is the only capable institution in the country and that they should really run everything and everyone else should just get out of the way or accept a subservient role to the military. Even the people in international financial institutions will speak about that, that this is a real problem, the growing sort of mushrooming role of the military everywhere, including in the economy.
And as we close, Michelle, in that regard, what does the population say? Do we know what Egyptians are thinking? Are they going to ratify these constitutional changes that would allow Sisi to serve until 2034?
What Egyptian citizens are saying right now is not much. And it's also hard to know what they're thinking because the traditional media has been largely taken over by state-owned or state-financed companies. There really is no longer a viable, independently owned media in Egypt, which is very sad because they had it for a while. And so it's hard to know what they think. What is probably the most likely scenario is that when these constitutional amendments are put to a popular referendum, that many people will try to stay home and stay quiet. The state will try to bus employees of public sector companies and so forth to the polling places to vote for the referendum. There has been some discussion, talk on social media and so forth of Egyptians going out to vote no for the referendum or protesting in some other ways, wearing black on the day of the referendum. We don't know right now whether any of that will really materialize, but it would take a great deal of courage because the price of expressing any opposition in Egypt now is extremely high.
Michelle Dunn is the director and senior fellow in the Middle East Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace here in Washington. Thanks again, Michelle, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol. It's been a great conversation.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. And joining me on the program were Mohammed El-Shanawi, VOA Senior Middle East Reporter, and Mitch Biter, Assistant Producer in VOA's Current Affairs Unit. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.